Mercy Spirituality Center presents Muffin Talk with Beate. Kia ora and welcome to our Muffin Talk. Muffin Talk is brought to you by the Mercy Spirituality Center in Ipsum. We are a center for retreats, spiritual guidance, Christian meditation and personal development. Once a week, I invite a visitor to join me in the studio to talk about our center, our programs, the Mercy World, social justice, or the wider church. Today, my visitor is John Fawcett. John, a warm welcome and haere mai to our radio program.
Yeah, kia ora, Beate. Thank you. It's good to be here.
John Fawcett is a spiritual director and an Anglican priest in Auckland, but he has spent most of his career in humanitarian work with primary focus on disaster response. He uses his vast experience for consultation services, resilience check-in. Well, John, you've worked in disaster response in many countries in the world. How did you first get involved in this kind of work?
Yeah, you know, that's a really great question because it's when you look back, I create these kind of stories about how I became involved and what was the thing that actually brought me into this. My earliest memory is actually of being on a ship sailing from New Zealand to England. My father was the ship's doctor. And I remember being excited about going through the Panama Canal. I was only 4 years old. And I think from that point on, I became interested in the idea of new places and traveling to new places. And so that kind of continued. I developed a career in social work here in New Zealand and then was invited to go to Cambodia. And that came out of the blue. I took it and we went and didn't look back. That was 25 years ago now.
Who invited you?
It was World Vision International. I'd been working alongside World Vision here in Auckland with a social services-based program. And the program in Cambodia was just developing after the United Nations held elections in the early 1990s. And they were looking for staff. And my friend who was working at World Vision said, John, have you ever thought about working in Cambodia? And I have to confess that I vaguely knew where Cambodia was, but not really. So I said, yes, why not? And so my wife and I had a chat and we ended up in Cambodia for nearly 7 years all told.
Amazing. You just had a chat and then you went.
Yeah, well, it's probably more of a little bit more in-depth chat, you know, we're blessed. Our friendship, our relationship, our partnership between the two of us is one where we share interests of adventure and excitement. And so, you know, the chance to go to a place like Cambodia was something we thought, look, we'll treat it as a camping trip. If it goes well, it goes well. And if it doesn't, well, we can always come back home.
And you've worked in international organizations. Can you tell us more about this work that you did?
Yeah, so working with international aid organizations is, I'm biased, I know, but it's one of the most exciting careers opportunities in the world. And so there are many of them. World Vision International, which was the first one I worked for, it's the biggest, what they call, faith-based Christian organization globally. But I also worked for Save the Children, and that's another huge organization globally. And you meet such fascinating people. It's one of those careers where you can make the most of it in any way that you like. And they provide services that range from the simplest provision of emergency response right through to long-term solutions in education, health, economic support, all kinds of things. And the great thing I found about it was that the majority of the people that work in those organizations are locals. They're people who are employed locally. So you really get to know people from many, many different cultures and contexts, and it's been just a wealth of experience. Thoroughly enjoyed it.
What language did you speak with the Cambodians? Did you speak English or did you learn some Cambodian?
Well, this is always the big challenge for anyone who works in international work is that you try to learn the local language, but the locals want to learn English, French, or Spanish. And so as much as we tried to learn Khmer, the Cambodians were trying to learn English. So you'd have this conversation where my very, very poor Khmer would then be repeated back to me in English, which was better than my Khmer. And in the end, you kind of basically gave up.
But I think it's a good practice if it's repeated in English,
absolutely,
then you know what came over. And but there might be some people who don't understand any English, so it's good to know some of the language,
that's true.
Local language.
And you know, the history of colonialism around the world means that you're if it's not English, it's likely to be French or possibly Spanish. And so there's combinations of all of those languages plus the local language as well, which makes life very interesting and can be incredibly humorous as well.
And what are for you the most important experiences that you learned during that work?
I think the most important thing I learned was that I needed to learn how to be a student. That there's a kind of underlying culture in the West that we have answers, and that there's this kind of feeling that in the West that we go out and we give people who don't have answers on how to solve their problems. And what I learned over the last 25, 30 years is that, in fact, most people know what the answers are. It's not a matter of knowledge. It's a matter of how do you actually implement those answers in this context. And so what I think I've learned is that it's really, really important to listen. First off, maybe for the first 5 or 6 years, do lots of listening, and only then maybe speak.
But also when you come from your culture, you have a different context, and you mentioned the word context, because one solution in one place might not be the right solution in another place.
No, absolutely not. And if my biggest criticism of the international aid world is that it relies on big solutions, money and infrastructure, whereas what we've learned really is that it's social interactions, relationships, and culture that really hold the success for the future for any place. And infrastructure comes second after that.
And the results are also different. Like you say, what is the outcome of a project, for example?
Yep.
And you might want to measure it with university degrees, but that doesn't help the country because the person might leave the country.
No.
But if you build up a community that has a long-lasting impact on the country.
And the problem with university degrees or with education is that there's not a problem with education per se, but if we walk into a context and argue that it's very important to have, say, a certain degree issued by a Western university in order to succeed in life, then people will have to buy that as an idea. In actual fact, the wisdom in local contexts is far in excess of what we can gain in most education systems in the West. And that's the other thing I think I've learned, is that wisdom is different to knowledge. And knowledge is kind of like applied wisdom. But in order to create a solution in a particular context, we need to listen to the wisdom of that context first and then see whether there's anything in my knowledge that could assist that wisdom to develop, future services for people in that context.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very, very difficult thing. As I said, it goes back to listening. Somehow we have to learn how to listen.
We have to listen. For those of you who just tuned in and who started to listen, you're listening to Muffin Talk with Beate. And this program is brought to you by the Mercy Spirituality Center in Ipsum. If you miss any of our programs, please check out www.planetaudio.org.nz/muffintalk or visit our website or Facebook page at Tengaka Waiora Mercy Spirituality Center. My visitor today is John Fawcett. John has worked many years in international humanitarian support, and one of his experiences that he learned was to listen. John, you say that during your work overseas in many countries that are considered economically poor, but you've learned that economically poor doesn't mean that the person is poor, isn't it?
No, right? That's absolutely right. And poverty measures more recently are beginning to include social aspects of what poverty means. One of the things that the research that we've conducted has really shown is that for an individual person to be healthy, they need to have a really, really good social network. And social networks you cannot classify in terms of monetary terms. We look in the West, we tend to look at wealth in terms of how good our roading systems are, how good our education systems are, how good our internet communication systems are. But actually what's most important is how many friends do you have? How many good friends do you have? And we can use that kind of measure of wealth across any kind of community anywhere in the world. And so what I found is that communities that are actually really strong and quite resilient are ones that have very, very good networks of friends, family and community working together. You don't have to have a brand new car or a brand new phone, but you do need to have friends. And so what I think that other cultures can teach the West is the value of friendship and social community.
And I was just thinking of the blessed are the poor in spirit.
Absolutely.
Poor is not just material.
No. In fact, I think that that really poverty is about social isolation rather than about wealth or access to funds. Yes, of course, people need a place to sleep, they need shelter, they need food, and they need good health. But the way we wrap those services around people is through connections with people, not with connections with technology. It's got to be about people. People, people, people.
Building up a community. But it's difficult to measure.
Very difficult to measure.
It's easier to measure how many dollars you earn than to measure how many friends do you have and what are friends.
Yes.
In today's age, it's a bit difficult.
Absolutely. So there's some very, very good research done on social communications and the value of particular social interaction. So I can classify on my, say, my Facebook feed how many so-called friends I have, but actually they're people whose names appear on a computer screen. Real friends are people who you can actually make real assessments of how deep a family relationship is or a friendship relationship is. And so it relates to how much time do I actually spend with a person face to face? What do we do when we're together? What are our shared interests? And it's not shared interests by sitting and looking at a screen together. It's about communicating with each other. So you can, in fact, measure those things. And there's a lot of very good research now that's coming out that is actually looking at countries and communities and looking at what are social values in those. So it's possible. Mm-hmm. We can do that.
And have you always dreamt of helping people in other countries?
No, I mean, I looked at that question. I thought that's really interesting. And it's not the other countries part that's important in that question to me. It's the helping people. And it doesn't, for me, what is interesting is how people are both extremely different, but also extremely similar. So it can be the same thing, and I know I'm harping back to the social relationship and a friendship. We can say that friendships are the same across the world, but the way in which a friendship is manifest or shown differs between cultures. So that when we're looking and trying to measure what friendship is, we can't just use the same behaviours in every context. So what I've enjoyed about working cross-culturally is to see how social relationships differ but are actually based on I think, unique things like trust and wisdom, but they're just talked about or expressed in different ways. And so for me, I grew up, I guess, in a household that explored the new, and my father and my mother always saying, look for new things. And so that really where it goes back to for me is the story of exploring the new. So not so much other countries, but other people. And I've been really, really blessed with the opportunity to actually visit so many different countries and see how that works in practice.
Last week we had a group of people here in the interview, and it was Jocelyn Armstrong from the Interfaith Council, who had organized a Leadership Diversity Day with young people who were meeting from different religions, different faith groups, and they were meeting on a marae, and the two students she had brought with her, they were just amazed how similar and yet different the other students were.
Yeah.
And they got along so well with each other that they said that's an enrichment.
Yes.
So they know these are neighbors and now they are not strangers anymore.
Yes.
Because they have learned something about their background and their beliefs, which makes the person.
Yeah, and I think that the biggest danger, I think, in the world today is the stereotyping of difference and the way in which we become isolated in our sort of technological silos and look at other races and other cultures as being so different that they're not like us. You need to sit down in the same room, share some food, and share some jokes, share some music, and realize that actually people are the same, in their core personalities, but we share things a little bit differently. But that difference is fantastic. That diversity makes life so rich. It makes life so worthwhile. I mean, I think anybody who just spends all their time with their own race and culture is missing out on so much possibility. Mm-hmm. So I'd say, get out there. Go and find some people who are different to you. Sit down, share a cup of coffee or a drink or something or other, and enjoy the music together.
Just be careful with the jokes, because a joke is often a little bit tricky. If you have different religions and different
nationalities,
you have to be careful.
But I think what I learned about that was that people are immensely forgiving if you're being honest. You know, if you're not coming across as being overbearing and pompous and knowing it all, but you're just honestly trying to build a relationship, then most people in most places will help you say the right thing and do the right thing at the right time. They will forgive us. So there's a lot of forgiveness out
and
there in the world.
We are back at listening.
Yes, we are back to listening.
And your skills that you learned in the different countries, are you able to use these skills of how to cope, for example, in emergencies in New Zealand, because you were working in emergencies?
Yes. So I was involved in the response to the Christchurch earthquake, and that was a very interesting experience working in your own home country, because it brings out all of the personal things that you experience. We lived in Christchurch for many years. Our daughter was born in Christchurch. It feels like home, and to go back there and see the places that were ours that had been destroyed, it was emotionally very challenging compared with going to Haiti or Nepal, where I went to, where they weren't my home. The devastation was terrible, but it was a different level of experience.
You didn't see the towns before in Haiti?
In Nepal I had, but not in Haiti, no.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you were using the skills in Christchurch?
And yes.
You're working with the people?
Yeah. And one of the key things that I've learned is, and this is the core of the work that I do today, is that most people cope with most things most of the time. And the idea that people are so traumatized by events that they cannot function is an idea that has been at the source of a lot of problems in global mental health from a Western perspective. But what we're learning is that, in fact, most people handle coping with disasters. And what they really need to be allowed to do is to get on with doing it. So the big contrast for me between Haiti and Christchurch is that in Haiti, people were actually allowed to start rebuilding their own houses and their own businesses because they know how to do it.
And they don't have an insurance.
Exactly, and they don't have insurance. The thing I saw in Christchurch was, the shame I saw in Christchurch was, and I think this reflects the whole professionalism that approaches to helping in places like New Zealand, United States, Canada, or wherever, is that people are not allowed to go and start trying to repair their own work. They're required to keep out. So only professionals, so-called professionals, can go and do in. And this is because to try and protect them. But actually, people actually cope with disasters quite well. The majority of people do. And what we really need to do is to actually sit back and listen again. Sit back and listen. What is it the community would like to do in this place? How can we help them do that rather than imposing a solution from outside, whether it's our own country or whether it's another country?
And I think that if you had such a disaster and you keep yourself busy with rebuilding, it might distract your mind rather than sitting there and waiting for somebody to allow you to go.
Yep. So what we found is that people cope best when they have a plan and they are allowed to go and try and implement that plan. And community plans are the best, so that if you can permit a group of people to gather together in their local community and identify what steps they'd like to take in order to improve the situation and help them with the resources that they require, then in fact the community knows how to do that. Then you've got community resilience and you build community relationships and things get a lot better, a lot quicker.
And I understand that you've been back now 6 years?
Yes.
And but you're still involved supporting missionaries and staff of international missions organizations?
That's correct, yes.
What kind of work is that?
So what I like to do now is I work with management teams or team leaders, people who are taking people overseas to work and work with coaching them in terms of how they can build the strength and resilience of the people that they're working with. And I'm able to do that now because of technology. I'm able to do a lot of that from home, which is much better than sitting on planes.
Yeah.
And I think it actually reduces my carbon footprint significantly.
Absolutely.
By just sitting at home and talking on Skype. So that's the kind of thing I try and do now, do remote work and reduce the amount of time I spend in airplanes.
Yeah. And you had your time on the planes.
I did. And while I enjoyed that opportunity, I look back on that and say, if only there'd been a better way for us to create those relationships without having to use all of that carbon on planes to get us to where we are, because that's contributing to a lot of the problems that we're seeing globally now. Mm-hmm. So it's a two-edged sword, I think, really.
But there are still people out there with other people, because this face-to-face is so important.
Absolutely. Face-to-face is really important. The advantage of the technology is that it really does allow the local people to do their own work and to use me as a resource if they need it.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than me doing the work and telling them what I have to do, it's much more working alongside and asking them questions about how do they manage their own health and well-being and how they're creating a context where health and growth can continue.
Can you give us one example?
Yeah, so I've been working quite a lot with a team that works in Africa, actually across the whole of Africa, so not just in one country, working to try and develop health programs in the wake of the Ebola outbreak in Western Africa. And the big issues that they face there are the fear that they may become infected themselves by the disease, and how do they maintain their own physical health while interacting with people in the community in an effective way, without creating barriers between them. But you've got to wear all this protective garb to make sure that you don't get infected. At the same time, we know that the best way of building community relationships is to be able to sit down and share food and space with people. So that becomes psychologically very stressful for people. And for the folk that are doing the work, they feel more and more isolated in their safe places from the communities they're working with. And so what I do with them is try and help them to develop means of communicating with people locally that are going to be physically safe, but will also enhance the relationship between them and the people they're working with. And so that is not just with Ebola, obviously. It can work with any kind of condition as well. It can be also in civil war. How do you relate carefully and safely with people who are involved in the civil war, keeping yourself and your family safe while at the same time forming proper relationships with the people you're working with. That creates a lot of psychological stress. And so my job is to try and help them develop strategies that are going to reduce that stress, maintain their health, but also be effective in their mission.
Do you feel that sometimes the people from other countries who are trying to help in an emergency are stressed more than the people who are directly affected, who had lost maybe everything they had?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that the resilience is different?
Yeah, it is. And I think that part of it is to do with this feeling of powerlessness. Local people, no matter how devastating it has been, are often thinking about what they're going to do next in order to make things better or restore things, and they're going to use whatever they have at hand. The people that come in from outside can see something or other that is more like a vision of 20 years down the track. And they're trying to make that happen today. But they're also, if you come in from outside, you're isolated from your own social support network. And so you've got two things going on. One thing, you want to make things better immediately, which is impossible. And the other thing is that the people you would spend your time with socially in community are back overseas somewhere other else. So this research that we've shown is that actually people do, the more isolated you are from the work that's being done, the more stressed you actually are. The most stressed people in international organizations are actually the people who live in the first world context, the headquarters office.
Because they feel responsible for helping them quickly, and they can't do anything themselves.
That's right.
But that reminds me of what you explained before with Christchurch, that people who had their houses who wanted to do something and who wanted to do it quickly because they knew, for example, if the house is empty for so and so long, it will deteriorate immensely, and they can't do anything.
Yeah. The worst thing I think we can do in a disaster response like that is to restrict people's access to their own property. We need to be able to trust people to have common sense. And most people have common sense. They're not going to put themselves or their family in danger. But if they can secure their own property and their own possessions, then they're doing something with their hands and with their mind. Stress levels, psychological stress levels go down, significantly go down. And we can measure that and we can show that that happens.
But aren't there some kind of preparations, so in case of an emergency, that people are not just, all of a sudden in a different situation, but that they have some kind of preparation in a non-stressful environment so that in case it's just like learning how to fall.
Yeah. Now, definitely, I think that there's two levels. One is that we need, as individual human beings, to know how to manage the stress that comes upon our own lives. And because we don't know what can happen, it's very hard to plan for everything that can happen.
Absolutely.
But we do need to know, okay, if I get stressed, what am I likely to do? Am I likely to get angry? Am I likely to be depressed? Am I likely to get violent, or am I likely to drink lots of alcohol? If I know those things, then I can predict what's going to happen for me if something happens. For those that are going to do the actual helping, like the first responders, they need to know the whole range of what people may, how they may respond to this accident. They also need to know how they're going to respond, and they need to know how their team members are going to respond. So for those that are responding, there's a lot of training that is done in order to prepare them for what they see and experience for themselves and to work as a team. Mm-hmm. But for most cases, we can rely on people to have common sense. And that's the thing that I think we really have missed in the West, is that this is feeling that the only way you can do something is by getting a university degree. Not true. And talk to the Tangata Whenua. They will tell you, we know what wisdom is. We know what we need to do. Just give us the space to do it, and we can do it.
So we'll have to listen, build up our communities, and then rely on people having common sense.
Exactly.
Thank you very much, John.
You're welcome.
It was a pleasure to have you here. And what is coming up in our Mercy Spirituality Center on Thursday, the 14th of September, from 7 to 9 p.m., Sister Alice Sinnott will repeat her lecture on wisdom, a female figure in the Bible. So back to wisdom. This session is a repeat of the one in July. We had very good feedback on that evening event, and now we're repeating it for those who are not able to come during the day. We're also planning to have a follow-up on this seminar, and this will take place on Monday, the 18th of July. On Saturday, the 23rd of September, from 9:30 a.m. to 4 p.m., Joy Cowley is going to facilitate a retreat day with the title From Head to Heart. And from the 28th of September to the 9th of November, we will have 6 regular evening sessions based on the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius of Loyola. And please remember that we have our regular events. We offer Christian meditation on Monday evenings at 7:30 p.m. and on Thursdays at 8 at 1 o'clock in the morning, at midday. And we have Lectio Divina on Thursdays at 2 p.m. For these regular events, which take place in our chapel, you can just turn up. But for all other events, please register with us per phone at Auckland 09-638-6238 or via our website, www.mercyspiritualitycentre.org.nz. I wish you all a blessed Friday and a good week ahead. Thank you, John.